You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
So with that, I want to introduce again Sarah Blackland. Sarah's been a big boost to the NC Choices program, and of course the energy behind this conference. And she's supposed to come up here, but I don't see her. Oh, there she is. Okay, stand up. That was your cue to stand up, Sarah. So very excited. Come on, let's. Yeah, Sarah is an amazing person and is really great to work with. So. We appreciate her leadership in this, and it's always fun to work with Sarah because it all ends up working out good, and you feel good about it. So, with that, I look forward to a really great day of programming. A little bit more emphasis on scientific things today, and talking about climate change and some other things. And so, we're very excited to see you in the halls and around in the sessions today. We hope you have a great conference and have a safe trip home, Sarah.
Thanks, Matt. I'll get you your check for saying all those really nice things about me in a minute. Thank you guys so much. I'm just here for a second. You guys really don't need to hear from me, but I do want to introduce the keynote who you're excited to hear about. There's actually a couple keynotes. It's Patrick Martins, and we're also going to have Emily Pearson up here. So I'm just going to read from the paper because there is so much they have done. If my brain were to remember it, it would not happen. So. We're going to have, just so you know, Patrick's going to give a little presentation for about 15 minutes, and then we're going to have my phone's ringing, and then we're going to have a live recorded, it's going to be aired, radio show conducted right here. So Mr. Patrick Martins is the founder of Heritage Food, Heritage Radio Network, and Slow Food USA. He's also the author of Carnivore Manifesto. There's books out there again in the lobby. If you're interested, he was born in New York City's Mount Sinai Hospital. I love this bio. On February 10th, 1972. Later, he received a master's degree in performance studies at New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. Patrick works with an excellent team to run a distribution business for heritage breeds of livestock and poultry. Again, he's the founder of Heritage Foods USA, Heritage Radio Network, author of the Carnivore's Manifesto. And in 2004, he and a friend produced New York City's Trivia Game. And so you're going to hear the podcast today, the Main Course OG, where they are interviewing 5 North Carolina meat makers, basically 5 folks who are doing cool things here in the state. Emily Pearson will be up there for the radio interview. She's the director of wholesale at Heritage Foods. After working in PR for several years, she went on with a Tuscan Italian chef and was the right hand from 2013 to 2016. And at Heritage, she oversees relationships with over 150 restaurants and Care Masters. She's also very engaged in marketing and social media for the company and co-hosts the Main OG, which y'all will hear today, with the Heritage Radio Network. So with that, I'm going to just hand it over to Patrick and then let you take it from there. Thanks, y'all.
Here it is. Well, thank you. It's such an honor to be here, a really proud moment for me to be talking to everybody. I think this insert pretty much explains everything I'm going to be talking about today perfectly. I'm sure everyone understands it. As my friend Renato, who started a pasta company, said, I can be very boring when it comes to talking about pasta. And likewise, I can be very boring when it comes to talking about heritage foods. So Basically, this is the thing I'm using now. It changes from time to time, but I basically think if I know what is in each of those houses and how each of those houses is decorated, basically Heritage Foods will run. And if cobwebs develop in any of those houses and I have no idea what's going on in one of them, then that will be failing, perhaps. So I'll just start in no particular order. One of them is the internet, so Shopify. Heritage Foods, we're a meat distributor, as she said, of pasture-raised heritage breeds. So Shopify is one thing I worry about. That is our website, and that's how people order from us. A lot of you guys have the catalogs there. And our website is how people go on and purchase, regular consumers. So basically, as you see, we have hundreds and hundreds of items, different breeds of pork chops, all the cuts of nose to tail of pork and beef and lamb and goat. So essentially, it's like a storefront. It's like a window in a department store. Each of those products is its own window, and we have to make sure that we're saying something intelligent, that we're talking about the cut, but also the heritage breed and the project, that we give enough information, but not too much information. So basically, you know, I'm telling you all the industry secrets from us, but you know, basically I think we pay $2,500 a month for Shopify. And then we need a young person to come and build it all out and put the pictures in. So we have a young person, Catherine, who does all that, and we pay the $2,500 for Shopify, and that is the bones of how people can order. And Shopify is really a fantastic website. We have about 40,000 people on our email list, and so we've always taken it upon ourselves, even though it can be a pain in the butt, to send a weekly email. So every single Tuesday at the same time, we send an email featuring a new food. So it's easy when there's a seasonal food. As you guys know, we do not artificially inseminate any of our animals that we work with. And so naturally mating animals, many meats are seasonal. Turkeys, ducks, geese, lambs, goat are seasonal. So those are very easy emails because we're like, we just got in 400 goats. So we're going to promote Goat-tober instead of October. We call it Goat-tober. So I'll explain that in a second. So anyway, the Tuesday email. So we think about it. What's the title of the email? The title is the thing that will either get people to open the email or not. So the best word for us to get our 40,000 people to open the email is new or premier or first time, so people click. When we know something's not going to sell because it's not so interesting, like we have trouble selling lamb, so sometimes we don't even put lamb in the title. We just put like unbelievable opportunity, new, you know, and so people click in and then we hope to get them through the photo. It's important to have good photos, important to have taglines. That's the next thing we think. So what do we say about our lamb? Four different breeds, all the cuts, nose to tail. We're always thinking of new things. Like when we sold quarter hogs in parts and eighth cattle in parts, no one bought it. But when we called it hog shares and cattle shares, we sold a few. So, you know, secrets to the trade like that. Now, something else is our catalog. We come out twice a year with the catalog, and that's very important. And you know how, what it looks like, what deserves a hero shot, what deserves just a little shot. You know, a hero shot of bacon might not be as good as a hero shot of porchetta or, you know, a whole lamb leg or something. So turkey gets its own house, because it's a seasonal product. We work with, we get about 8,000 turkeys from Frank Reese. He's in right outside of Salina, Kansas, and he raises six breeds, and they're the oldest line of genetics of turkey in America. They go back to the 1840s. They've only been on two farms since the 1840s or 50s, and they're all endangered. They're all on the brink of extinction. Very few people take the time to raise these older breeds, and very few companies pay farmers. So these farmers are not incentivized to raise these older breeds. As we say, you have to eat them in order to save them. Eat them to save them. By eating them, we're increasing their population counts. And we love the rare breeds, the heritage breeds. We think they have great marbling. We think they have great stories. We also think they're part of our gastronomic history, which for us is no different than our architecture history or our art history. You know, it's very important to save these foods of our past. So that's turkey. It is a nightmare. We get 8,000 turkeys out of the slaughterhouse on one day. We don't know how many grade A birds there'll be, how many grade B birds, which means they have to get cut into parts. We sell them in 2-pound increments from 8 to 10, 10 to 12, all the way to 22 to 24. His birds average about 15, 16 pounds, which is great for heritage breeds. Most people who raise heritage breed turkeys, those turkeys average like 8 or 9 pounds. So he's really good. He has great genetics, and he is the last of his kind. I really encourage everybody to look up Frank Reese and Good Shepherd Poultry Ranch. I mean, totally one of a kind. Goat gets its own house, Goat-tober. My wife is a cheesemonger, and she said every time a dairy has a male goat, there's no purpose for that male goat. I'm a city boy. I found this out late, but you cannot milk a male goat. So there's no outlet for them. And a lot of them get euthanized. So we started a project called Goat-tober, or No Kid Left Behind. And thank you. So, you know, we did that, and so we sell about 600 goats. A lot of time, because our stuff costs more, they're heritage breeds, we only deliver to restaurants once a week, it's more expensive, as I say, so we're always trying to become extra valuable to people. So, for instance, to Frank Reese, this turkey farmer, we're trying to do a business plan to launch a kind of turkey zoo or a conservancy on his farm where the public can come. So that way we're not just like, how many birds do we have? How many birds do we have? We're trying to become a little value added to him so he doesn't not raise enough birds. By the way he does it, he raises all the poults on his farm. You know, the little poults are born on his farm. He sells them to other farmers under the condition that they sell the poults back. So, you know, he ends up having a nice little network like that. Extra pigs is one of the things. We're always trying to get extra pigs, but our slaughterhouse limits us to about 250 pigs a week, which is a challenge. Emily and I, two Jews from New York, sell about 60,000 pounds of pork a week, which is unusual. My mother is always like, tell people you sell turkeys too, not just pork. But the turkeys, really pork is our only wholesale item. It's our only wholesale item. So we have trucks going to about 7 cities, and then we have local delivery services deliver the food. The restaurant name is written on the boxes by the slaughterhouse. So the local delivery services just have to deliver them. So it saves a 30% markup and makes it into like a 7 or 10% markup. So it allows us to pay the farmers what they need. We're always trying to get extra pigs. We're always trying to get the slaughterhouse to give us more space, which is a challenge because they don't want to just be in the processing. They want to own the pigs themselves, and we're probably 70, 80% of their business. So, you know, it's hard to get them to do more pigs. Tony and Pepe, who the hell are they? They're on the sheet. They are value added. If we just sell raw meats, we're not as interesting to our mail order consumers. So we have to deal with these talented, temperamental artisans. You know, we're like, I put too much oregano in the bruschetta. I know I'm not going to deliver it. We're like, we need them. I'm sure it'll be delicious. Please just deliver us the friggin' porchettas. We pre-sold like 300 of them. So we deal with these guys, and they don't love dealing with us because we're like, can you make a roast for us, and they're like, I got all these other things to do. I got to make 500 roasts for you. We actually call our, instead of a rollatini, we call it a rollatoni, because Tony from Tempesta Artisans makes our rollatonis. Pepe makes sausages, so we're sending him cheese from my wife and asking him to put it in the sausage so we could do a cheese sausage, you know, and all these things. Always trying to find new ways to make ourselves interesting so that we don't get forgotten about. Wednesday, does it say that? Talk less. That's a message to me, to let the staff talk more, the team I work with. Accounts receivable is basically once every 2 weeks we work on accounts receivable. It's really hard to keep everybody at 30 days. of these restaurants. Restaurants are more like at 60, 80 days. So we're constantly calling. We're, again, hey, we don't just call and be like, where's our money? We're like, hey, we should do an event next month, or, oh, we're going to include you in our chef spotlight. You know, we're always trying to find ways on the to be useful. On the dark side of it, if someone stiffs us, what do we do? Do we just not say anything? No, we don't believe in that. There's this kind of energy of, oh, well, you know, we don't want to be the ones to report someone who does something bad. We think the opposite, that the local businesses like us who struggle for every dollar should be told that there's a person who stiffs them out there so that they don't make the same mistake we did by selling them. So we kind of have an internal list, no one in this room. Flash, cash, I mean, our accounting, inventory, contracts, legal, we try to keep that next to nothing because we need to be marketing. We need to be finding out new ways to tell our story to the people. So, you know, inventory, yields, we're not so into stats, you know, we're into just offense, like Dan Marino, my favorite quarterback of all time. Never made a Super Bowl, but man, he was always passing and setting records. So we kind of take that tact. I think I have up there the cuts we cannot sell. Hams are our scariest. It's about 80 pounds out of a 240-pound carcass. So we partner with, hopefully with Lady Edison starting soon, you know, to buy some of their hams. Actually, we're really trying to push the whole ham business. We sell to Sam Edwards. He was buying about 6,000 pieces a year. His plant burned down. So we were calling everybody, being like, we have a year's worth of pigs on the ground with all these farmers who have to sell to us because they don't have other outlets. What are we going to do with our hams? And people rally. Al Benton rallied for us. Broadbent Hams rallied for us. Cesare Casella started a ham curing business out of nothing just to be able to take a few pallets. I mean, Al Benton said something very touching. He said, I talked with my team, you know, because our stuff costs 50, 60 cents more a pound than what he could buy normally. It's like, I talked with our team. I told them what happened with Sam Edwards' plant burning down, and we decided to forego improvements on our plant so that we could take 30 pallets over the next few months of your hams. Super touching, kept us in business, kept our farmers in business, turned Alan into even more of a hero than he already was. Yeah, hams are a stress because we sell to about 200 restaurants a week, and we sell about three pieces of ham to that group. They buy every other cut of the pig as a group, but they only sell two or three hams. So meanwhile, the ham people, they really take. Volpe Foods in St. Louis, they've helped us. So what else do I have on here? Events, we try to do events. Blogs, you know, I try to write a blog. Other things, this is the part I don't like. I always joke that YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook are merging into a mega conglomerate called YouTwitface. I just don't like YouTube. But we got to play the game. It's a modern game. There are young people out there. So, you know, I've learned to delegate that to young people who just take over the Instagram, take over the Facebook, and run that because you need that in order to be successful. We're always, I learned from David Newman, who's going to be speaking later, about stressing okra. If an okra plant is underperforming, you kind of whack it and it overproduces. So stress the okra. We're always trying to get our mail order customers to buy, instead of once a year, to buy three times a year. So we're sending deals and packages and anything we can just to try to stress the okra, get them to overperform. Hams we talked about. Wholesale, you know, Emily and I, having a salesperson, you know, I think a lot of times I hear people not have a salesperson first. The salesperson is the engine in a way, and we're always on the phone Mondays and Tuesdays trying to sell all 400 pieces of those 200 pigs, 400 country ribs, 400 bellies, and that can be really a challenge. It can really be a challenge. One of the things we've done to help that is a staff meal. So we call the chefs, we have about 40 of our accounts will take staff meal. So they just tell me how many pounds they'll take and the, you know, most of them are around 50 or 60 pounds, and they will take whatever cut we send them for $2 a pound. It's not what we want to do, but we're very happy to do it just so that we don't have a frozen inventory. So some people get great deals, basically. And we might have 900 pounds of country ribs that we couldn't sell. So by the time you get through the 50 pounds to each account, you know, we're okay. One of the things, I mean, I also have written on this sheet, but not there, you know, we're hoping that, you know, some of our bigger restaurant groups, because we're a boutique company, so we're, as you see by some of the prices and our catalog and all that, so we're trying to get some of these bigger restaurant groups that started with us small, but now have grown to cosmic success levels. And we're trying to say, can you take boneless meat from us if we're ever in a jam? You know, kind of in that staff meal concept. So Danny Meyer, for instance, is a restaurateur in New York, Gramercy Tavern, Union Square Cafe. You know, he has this Union Square Hospitality Group, which is like a commissary for airlines and all that. And so, you know, we're trying to get into the position where people understand that they have to help us. It's about, if you're rich and you've been successful in this business, then a certain percentage of your business should go to small family farms and heritage breeds. And that stays with you till the end. That's the last thing that should be cut from your program. You have a bad year, that should be the last thing that's cut, because that's the story, and you're embracing these people and their family farms and processors. I mean, we're probably the primary source of income for, if you add the slaughterhouse, maybe 90, 100 families. So we can't stop. We have to do it 52 weeks a year. So, you know, even though it's Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, you know, Emily's coming in for the first part of the day, and I'm doing my thing, and we sell on Mondays and Tuesdays. We convey all the cut orders to the slaughterhouse. Paradise Locker meets on Tuesday night. They spend 2-3 hours with it to convey it to their cutters. Wednesday, Thursday, the pigs are cut. And then Cannonball comes on Friday and delivers around the country. And we call the distributors on Monday morning and say, hey, you got 4 pallets or you got eight pallets, and here are all the restaurant accounts, and then those trucks go out. So, we're reaching into the holidays. So, you know, it's about centerpieces for us. It's about a big check average for our customers. Everything is kind of swollen. You know, I don't know why people eat more meat in the holidays, but I guess they do. It'd be nice if they sustainable meat all the time. I kind of just wanted to say something interesting. I mean, usually I just give my shtick about Heritage Foods started conceptually when the first McDonald's opened on the Spanish steps of Rome in Italy in 1986. A guy named Carlo Petrini, this bearded guy from Northern Italy, was like, what? McDonald's open in the Spanish steps of Rome, the most unique, beautiful piazza in all of Europe, and now there's that part of it that's the same as every other McDonald's in the world? He's like, no. So he started a pasta-eating protest in the piazza and started Slow Food. And it started very much as a gastronomic organization about a bunch of overweight guys sipping wine and trying to guess what cheeses they were blind tasting. It never took off. But in 1996, he turned the wheel of his group to become an eco-gastronomic organization. And the eco was basically a project that he called the Ark Project, like a Noah's Ark. It was a metaphorical ark, and they boarded onto that ark any endangered food or endangered food tradition. So the slower growing apricots or the eggplants that bruised easily, and so farmers were disincentivized to grow those kinds. And so they said, we're gonna try to promote those. They didn't really do projects for them. So when we came to the States, we were like, we need an actual project for these heritage turkeys that are on the brink of extinction. So Carlo Petrini, Slow Food, you know, if you read about his early history, he's a fascinating guy. Slow Food, the snail was their mascot. Which he said was delicious and also very slow, so it was perfect. And they had a magazine, and they organized nonprofit events all around the country, always supporting the food. And they also never believed in asking farmers to donate food to an event to promote. I mean, the last person you should be asking to donate. And farmers should be like, no way. I'm not going to donate to you. This is a project for me and my people. Like, you should pay for the food. Don't ask for donations. I don't know what happened here. I'm sure it was paid for. I mean, sorry if it wasn't, but I always believe farmers should be paid for their thing. And yeah, I mean, farmers should absolutely be, you know, paid for what they do. And I really admire, I mean, we have this David Newman here. I mean, it is hard work to be a farmer, especially with the rare breed genetics and trying to not inbreed them, having fewer pigs available each week because they grow very slowly, you know, but they taste really great. And, you know, a big part of what we are about is biodiversity, preserving biodiversity in the food world. And all these rare breeds contain within their genetics possibly the ability to resist a novel pathogen, or man-made, or natural. And, you know, I never understood I'm not supposed to say anything bad about big companies, but I never understood why they didn't preserve a little percentage of their business to keep the rare breeds alive. These are people who claim to love the chicken, but they've exterminated 99% of the chickens in the world. It doesn't make sense. Always a little bit of profit. And they claim, you know, for their investors that they're thinking about the long term. I question that. I think they're thinking about the next quarter only. And if you did really take your time, you would see that preserving these rare breeds are very important. And in fact, Purdue sent someone to our little farmer, Frank Reese, because they were like, we need some other genetics in here. Can you help? And they have to go to that little guy. They didn't even have it in their own system, and they made billions and billions of dollars a quarter. So we believe in that. Carlo Petrini also started a radio station, which we'll get to in a second. He started it in Bra. He used a transmitter from a Korean tank, from an American tank used during the Korean War, and he broadcast all this kind of hippie stuff in the 60s. Or in the 70s, and he got arrested because at the time, Italy was like, you cannot have an independent radio station. There's only room on the dial for our three state-sponsored stations, which couldn't have been more ridiculous, so he proved that wrong. But when he got arrested, it was their biggest mistake because all the intellectuals of Italy came to his defense and came to that trial and, you know, were staying in people's homes and on their couches in his little medieval town in northern Italy. And it really put him on the map. And with his fame, he started Slow Food to preserve regional cuisines and traditions. So we've talked about pretty much everything here. I think that's a lot of heritage. Emily, am I forgetting something?
I don't think so.
No? All right. Well, that's Heritage Foods. So yeah, wholesale.
Sales,
yeah, we woke up at 6 and had to call all our accounts. But you know, we always have to, yeah, we're always pushing. Now after 15 years, people respect us and see that we're, you know, are doing something legit. 15 years ago, people were like, who is this kid who keeps calling me? I don't need country ribs. I don't even know what that cut is. It's not even in the meat buyer's guide, and this guy's trying to sell me 4 cases. Sometimes if the guy didn't even say yes, we would still send him a case because we have to move everything. So, you know, we had this reputation, but, you know, you have to push. You know, you really have to push to get people to change. So yeah, so we're trying to do that, and we're trying to get bigger companies. I always say, always be opening. I'm always like, are we always opening? And Emily's like, shut up. So you know, we're trying to do that, and we try to give. One thing about our rare breed members I didn't mention. Our rare breed members are people who buy a lot from us online, but they're also chefs. So we always give extra. We give so many free gifts out to these people. Cutting boards, pork chops. We FedEx steaks to their family because we have to exist for them. We're so easily cut out. We only deliver once a week. Our stuff's more expensive. So we give to get. But in return, so just the other day, I sent a 10-rib rack to this guy in Chicago, real old Chicago. I mean, he must have been like an offensive lineman for the Chicago Bears or something. The guy sounds scary. I think he's a huge guy. And we sent him a 10-rib rack to him and his family. And then guess what? We were in a jam with 3,000 pounds of jowl, and he took it. And he cured it for us and sold it back to us. He let us jump the line. So that was a total example of where we got something by giving. You know, I always remember that one story of the Rothschild, the first Rothschild ever. He would undersell all the jewelry to the monarchy there in Germany or Prussia or whatever it was. He would undersell to the point where all of his kids were almost starving. But by underselling, by in a way giving to the richest people, the most powerful people, and some of the smallest, he, you know, became the sole jeweler to the monarchy, and you know, his family became, you know, the richest in every country. So it's kind of a lesson we've taken. We give to get. We try to be generous. We try to be funny. We try to be useful. Also, we try to never talk business with people. If I'm calling a chef, I ask about them, their lives, who they are, what they're doing, what events, what the menu is, and be like, oh yeah, and 2 cases of racks next week, cool. You know, and so we try to be that. So that's basically my shtick, and we go to the radio station, which is more interesting and more fun, and we have Katie, who's the executive director. Do you want to come up and say 2 seconds about radio, so before we just start into a show? No booing during the radio show, please. It is live.
Well, thanks, Patrick. I had a lot of time to prepare to speak to you while I walked from that chair to right here, but so happy to be here this morning. And I just want to say Heritage Radio Network is celebrating our 10th anniversary this year. Thanks, Patrick. We are a nonprofit organization. We have 35-ish weekly podcasts about food, beverage, and agriculture. They're all recorded live in our studio inside of a shipping container in Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Please come say hi to us if you're ever in Brooklyn. Have a pizza. Come knock on the plexiglass. Wave. We'll come out and say hi. You can learn more about us at heritageradionetwork.org. We're a member-supported organization, and so also I invite you all to participate in our membership program. Join us at events. You'll get lots of special emails. And all of our content is always available for free to anyone, anywhere in the world. That's really important to us. So thank you, everybody, for helping to continue to make that possible. If you're interested in agriculture or food politics or wine or cocktails or bacon or what else have we got? We've got bread. We have shows about representation and diversity in food media, so really, truly something for everybody. And if anybody's going to be in New York on November 11th, we're having an incredible gala. Patrick has helped us put together an incredible lineup of chefs for that, and you can learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/gala. We'd love to see you there, but I don't want to hold you up anymore. The main course was our first show ever on Heritage Radio Network. In fact, it was the only show. As I understand, it used to kind of go on, you know, at a time of week, not always the same time, and go for, you know, 2-3 hours, which is about the right length for one episode of radio. And since then, it's gone through a few iterations, and now is this incredibly polished show that you're going to see today, which is now why it is referred to as the main course OG, because Patrick and his crew are the original gangsters of Heritage Radio Network. So without further ado, I'll hand it back. Thank you.
Thanks. Emily, by the way, the radio station, we started literally so that chefs would continue to buy from us. I mean, we were like, hey, we got to put you on air, you know, come on. So we'll start a shipping container radio station with 0 listeners. And it's funny, everything we do still is asking a favor because we were still asking them to come be on the radio. So we're the best askers of favors, even though it looks like we're doing a favor for them. We're really not. They're doing the favor for us. But anyway, this is Emily. We were always struggling along until Emily came along, and she's the best sales communicator person in the world. I wish all of you sustainable people to have an Emily in your business, because it would definitely serve you well. So, you want to start the show?
Sure.
Good morning. Thanks for having us. So you've learned a little bit about who Heritage Foods is and who the Heritage Radio Network is. We are going to do our show, The Main Course OG. This is sort of like a live to tape. It will be up as soon as we're back, and Sarah is going to be sure to share the link with everybody so that you can listen again, share it. Listen in your car on the road and take a little bit of us with you. And then we actually hope you'd become a regular subscriber to either our show or any of the shows on the network if you like what you hear. So we have five panelists who are going to be part of our show. I see two of our chefs here. We have Greg Collier and Stephen Goff, if you guys can come up. We also have Donna Moore, Sam Suchoff, and Jeremiah Jones. So we like to equate our show a little bit to like The View, if you guys have ever seen it. Patrick likes to call himself Joy Behar. And so we always do an outline the day before the show. We share it with our panelists. We want them to feel like they're just organized enough and just off the cuff enough that we keep it fun and light and fast. So we do have some questions specifically geared towards each person, but we're gonna start off.
Emily goes between the McCain lady and Whoopi Goldberg. So just be prepared. You never know what she's gonna say.
Cody, are we good with all the mics? Cool, okay. So good morning. My name is Emily Pearson, and I'm gonna be your host for the next 45 minutes or so. As you may have heard by now, this is a live recording of The Main Course OG, which broadcasts via Heritage Radio Network, normally from the back of Roberta's Pizza in Brooklyn, New York. As Katie mentioned, we're a nonprofit radio station devoted to real issues and stories and food, and we're just one of almost 35 shows. So, my co-host needs no introduction after his keynote address. Patrick.
Thank you.
Fantastic work.
Thank you.
They all stayed awake. Can we give him another round of applause?
I hope that was the best keynote this morning. That was my goal, to be the single best keynote of the morning.
All right. Enough about us. We are honored to be with everyone today here in Charlotte at the Carolina Meat Conference. Thank you all for having us. We are going to jump into our segment called The Weekly Based. So we typically open our show with the fast-paced round robin to get everyone introduced and warmed up. We're going to start with a game of word association. For each of our guests here, we selected two words or terms for each of you, and we hope you'll respond in, 15 seconds or less, just to keep it cool and moving. So, first up, Sam Suchoff, owner of Lady Edison, an award-winning Chapel Hill, North Carolina barbecue restaurant, The Pig. Sam, your word is twang or funk.
Old ham. That good?
Sure.
Yeah. Explanation, or can I just throw it
out?
Yes,
there, yes. Like,
no, go for it.
Explanation.
So I do country hams with a fellow named Rufus Brown and Bill and Jim Goodnight, and they have been generous enough to leave space and time to hang my hams extra long. And the longer you hang them, the more they break down and get this really amazing funk or twang. And it's this amazing flavor, this kind of... when something starts to break down, you get this funk that sometimes can be a turnoff, but when it's the right level, it's just kind of exciting to eat, kind of eating on the edge of the, this is almost spoiled, but it's at its perfect point right now. Like fruit, like if you get, go to the farmer's market ever and strawberries are at the peak of season, sometimes I'll be walking through the farmer's market and it smells so good, And then at a certain point, I'm like, it kind of smells like rotten fruit. It's like the moment right before it's rotten is when it's at its peak. And so that funk and twang that I really enjoy in the country hams is kind of that. It's like the best moment before it's gone too far.
It's something that pasteurization kills, right? I mean, right. if you are a natural process, yeah, it stays.
Your follow-up word is vegan.
Well.
15 seconds or less, come on.
15 seconds, okay. Secret dark history. 13 years old, I became a vegetarian. I was in Los Angeles. My understanding of farming was basically that, or animal, farming was that it was done in factories and pretty disgusting. And I joined, Lisa Simpson and stopped eating meat. Later on in college, I became a vegan because why not? And then once I started working with food and realized there was another option, instead of just bowing out, I could take a proactive stance and actually support people who were doing things that could take the place of factory farming. And so the whole vegetarian vegan thing is the flip side of the same coin that is now, you know, has me involved in the death of 32 pigs every week.
Now, I was told by David Newman that Cam Newton went vegan and then proceeded to get injured all the time. And now he's eating meat again, and I guess is still injured, but whatever. There's something there.
All right, our next panelist, word association. We have Jeremiah Jones. Jeremiah is the president of the North Carolina Natural Hog Growers Association, the state's only wholesale pasture-raised hog marketing cooperative. Jeremiah, your word is row crop agriculture.
We grow all our own crops to make our own feed to provide our hogs. It's all non-GMO. To become non-GMO, I had to set up a processing facility to process and roast pressed oil out of soybeans to make bean meal. I do that for most of our group.
Cool. And your other word, grassroots.
The name my wife gave our farm. It's because we're going back the way the hogs started to be raised, the old-timey way.
Now, you're a grassroots organization. How do you get the word out? How do you promote yourself?
We didn't for a long time. We were word of mouth for the first 7 or 8 years, and we just started using Facebook. We're not real good at it, and we've just started designing a website. We've just used word of mouth because a bunch of our members are in their 70s and 80s, and they thought the internet was the worst thing ever. So we had to do a real good job, and all our business was by word of mouth.
Do they still say www before giving the internet each time?
They don't even have wires in their house. They don't even know they're on the internet. And I showed one of them, I Googled it, and it had 2 pages of his name and his town where he's from, and he was mad he was even on the internet.
Now you get to tell them you were on a podcast, too. Whole new world. All right, we have Greg Collier, chef owner of The Yoke here in Charlotte and co-creator of Soul Food Sessions, a nonprofit organization dedicated to raising awareness and enhancing opportunities for minority chefs. Greg, we have a very important one for you.
The New York breakfast.
Bacon, egg, and cheese.
Oh, man, bacon, egg, and cheese, man. That's easy. So, We got a breakfast restaurant, and we've been doing bacon, egg, and cheese for a while. But what I'll say about bacon is super dope. First of all, like, bacon is kind of one of those, everybody eats it, everybody makes it, it's all the same. And then the first time I had like a heritage breed pork belly, bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich, I damn near threw it at somebody. So we'll get into the importance about all that later, but that's all I got for bacon, egg, and cheese.
Awesome. Your other word is soul.
So how long we got? 15 seconds?
Yeah.
So obviously we do soul food sessions, and that's important. And one of the things specifically about soul, I think a lot of times soul in the context of food is kind of limiting. It's kind of like real specific and short-sighted. So I like soul, but I want people to look at it as you would with music or, you know, soulful versus just soul. Because kind of saying like soul food is kind of like, oh, well, I know what that is, but how about soulful food or cooking with soul or, you know what I'm saying, when you do something, having soul in that. I like that soul a little better.
Mm-hmm. I like that. You need a new restaurant with that name, Soulful. I like that. All right.
Ooh, not working.
We have some female representation on this panel. We have Donna Moore, the CEO and president of Piedmont Custom Meats, a USDA-inspected processing facility and custom meat fabricator here in North Carolina. Donna, we have the word sausage.
Sausage, that would be what we would consider value add. So something else that you can do with that pig or any species that we would actually process. So it's a value added product.
I felt like we were on a spelling bee where you were going to be like sausage.
Sausage.
S-A-U.
So how many sausages did you have to make before you were like, this is a perfect breakfast sausage for us, or a perfect kielbasa or whatever?
We keep it really simple. We use premixes that our customers like. And so we have about 12 different flavors that they can use.
Do they also get to come to you with a recipe and make their own, like private label?
We try not to. Because
right,
that
it.
Would
be
that a
idea.
Lot of changing in our HACCP plans and a lot of other things that go along with that.
Your other word is bureaucracy.
USDA, FSIS. Yeah. They're in the industry, being a slaughterhouse and or animal harvester and processor, there is a lot of regulations that probably most of our customers on a day in, a day out basis have no idea that we have to deal with. So it's the government.
Is that what keeps a lot of smaller plants out of business or not starting because of how much bureaucracy and paperwork there is?
I would say there's a lot to that, yes. Yes.
All right. Last but not least on our panel, we have Stephen Goff, executive chef and co-owner of Oxbar, Blind Pig, and Brine House Meat and Provisions Food Truck. And I think there's one more, right? Am I missing one restaurant?
No.
That's everything. So your word is parking.
That's a really hard one. Like, I saw that and I'm like, pain in the ass? I don't know.
Does your food truck stay parked, or is it mobile around the city?
It's mobile. I prefer to have it mobile rather than like parked in one spot. I've just found, at least in the cities that we've operated in, that's our better option.
And do you like tweet out, or as Patrick said, you twit face, tell the world where you're going to be?
We twit face here and there, but I'm not as good at it as I should be for the food truck anyway, but.
All right, your other word is hunger.
Hunger is something that is a very important issue to me. So hunger goes back, it just makes me think of, you know, at the restaurant, we sell a wooden nickel so that people can, like tourists or people that come in, can purchase a nickel and give it to a homeless or hungry person. And then they can come in, and it's not just getting a meal. It's not even necessarily dealing with hunger. It's that they can sit down and enjoy a meal in a restaurant like a regular person. So it's not even just the hunger that we do that for. And then, you know, I lived on the streets for a long time, so I just don't like to see people go hungry.
That's awesome. Can people, like, buy a wooden nickel from afar? Like, can you call or go online and...
I've never had that because, like, you know, our whole thing is that. So another thing with the nickel is I wanted people to take the nickel and have to actually talk to somebody. I mean, we do.
I know. People, I love that. That's cool. You get to actually see where you're
right,
where that drive and where your passion's going,
and see that it's like that's a human being. You know, a lot of people don't see that when they see someone on the streets.
Cool. Well, you guys did well. I'm impressed. We are going to keep going with the show. I have a question for a few of you. If our sustainable movement is to succeed, we must build alliances and make friends along the way. So Donna, Stephen, and Greg, what does hospitality mean to each of you?
Why are y'all looking at me like I'm supposed to take it from
you? You just threw a bacon, egg, and cheese at someone.
I know, right? So I got to be more hospitable. But I threw it at them because it was so good, delicious. It wasn't because I was mad at them. I mean, hospitality for me is kind of simple and extremely complex at the same time. I think hospitality should be about service. And that's at every level and every way you could possibly look at service. I think a lot of times in the kitchens, especially as chefs, we kind of feel like we're gods or lords over the food scene and that people are coming to see us. And, we forget the point of what we're doing is because we love to serve people and we love to feed people. So for me, hospitality is just, even when it gets tough, even when a customer or, you know, a relationship is not going the way you really want it to go, is to keep in mind that you're here to serve and improve someone's day. You're here to serve and improve the industry. The goal is to make someone happy through the thing that you're doing. So. I think hospitality is about keeping that focus and remembering that you're in the service industry, that does not mean you're a servant at all and whatsoever, but it does, however, mean that you're here in the service of other people. So please stay off your high horse and remain in the service industry.
And for us, hospitality is customer service, because at Piedmont, we don't buy anything and we don't sell anything other than a service. So our customers are our bread and butter, so we have to provide excellent customer service so they will continue to come back to us.
I mean, at Heritage, we couldn't do what we do 52 weeks a year, 200 pigs a week without our processor that we work with outside Kansas City. You know, Paradise Locker Meats is every bit of the triangle, circular, whatever we want to call it, relationship that allows us to function and to be hospitable and to take good care of our customers, and whether that be chefs or eaters. So I totally agree. Chef Steven, what about you?
I mean, I go the same as Greg along those lines of, you know, even hospitality should not even just be you and your guests, like your employees, your associates, your coworkers. When you're at an event with other chefs, be hospitable. Like, show that welcoming hand, you know, and that's part of what our restaurant in Asheville is about. Is like, I wanted it to feel hospitable, convivial, happy, you know, and that's the only way that, talking about building alliances and the sustainable food movement, we have to be hospitable and welcoming and welcome people in and not talk down and condescend, you know, if we want them to buy what we're selling, basically.
Or as Patrick says, talk less, right?
Yeah, talk less. The less I talk, the better. When someone's like, a chef's upset, I'm like, they need someone to be nice. Emily, you take this call.
So, Jeremiah and Sam, what is your leadership style?
Gosh, I mean, leadership, you know, makes me think of, you know, someone who has a goal and pulls people along with them to reach the goal. And I would say, you know, more than pulling people towards my goal, I try to do collaboration. I feel like, you know, I collaborate with the co-op to get, you know, all the pigs and parts and all that stuff out there, sold, turned into something, cooked into barbecue. I like finding people who have similar goals and kind of going at that goal together, as opposed to, you know, forming a team to all work towards, you know, whatever my goal is. I think it's, you know, a little bit easier. It fits my personality more. I don't really like telling people what to do. And I think, you know, it's hard to keep your stamina up when you're constantly pushing towards a goal. And if you have people around you who share that goal or who have a goal that's similar, you know, their own stamina pushes you along when you kind of are slow. So, you know, if I'm not having a great week, you know, I can talk to Jeremiah and we can BS back and forth about the hogs and, you know, who's got what and how things are going, and, you know, it pushes me forward. So I don't consider myself much of a leader, but I do consider myself a collaborator.
Jeremiah?
My leadership style is more forced than survival. We lost a contract that we always used to raise for one market, and I didn't want to get out of the hog business. So we formed a co-op, and I was the youngest, had a cell phone, and was able to turn on a computer somewhat. So I was picked as the leader. And nobody's trying to take it from me. So.
Good answer.
Well, Alice Waters once told me a story about a bakery in Paris that started, it was very small, and then they totally expanded. But when they expanded, they did not create a baking team with the first person most powerful all the way to the 100th person least powerful. They created out of a common fire, one fire in the center, and like rays of the sun, they were 12 independent baking teams. So you were never lower than the sixth person on the totem pole. And they all made the same bread, but with their own maybe charming inconsistency to it. But it was a great way to totally expand without kind of neutering the worker and all that. So I thought that's a great story, an inspirational story of how you can be a huge company while, you know, having a lot of independent groups in it.
So our next weekly base topic here, so if you become a regular listener of our show, which I know you all will, absolutely, after today, we always try to sneak in a question, usually about the royal family, but it wasn't resonating so much with this group. So we wanted to go a little more local, North Carolina.
Michael Jordan? Michael McDonald's?
I don't know. Which one? Which one? Game time decision.
Ronald McDonald, board of directors.
Okay. So if the Ronald McDonald House's board of directors, excuse me, the McDonald's board of directors was here today for the North Carolina Meat Conference, and you were assigned one buffet station, or let's say a single bite to feed them, what would you serve?
I mean, I guess I can't not say country ham. So country ham, but also my second favorite dish to serve buffet style is beanie weenies. Homemade hot dogs, all pork co-op. But.
Donna, what do you got for us?
How about a grass-fed, local grass-fed beef burger versus that other thing that they serve? Yeah, yeah, let's go with grass-fed beef burger.
Now, grass-fed beef burger, do you have to add more fat into it to make it tastier? I mean, is grass-fed sometimes not have enough fat in it, or how do people deal with that issue?
I think a true grass-fed burger is just, you don't need it. It is just what the trimming is from that particular animal. Nothing else is really needed. Yeah.
Chefs? We're expecting to be wowed here. Come on.
Yeah, good luck with that. Yeah, I mean, I was gonna go with sliders, but then Donna stole it. So
you can also have sliders, yeah.
Maybe a filet of fish, you know, because it's the unexpected hit of their menu, you know. So we could make an actually like local filet of fish with some meat glue and such.
Chef Greg,
my absolute favorite thing in life to cook are grits, and we have a recipe, so we got a couple recipes for grits. One of them is ham bone grits, so we take whatever ham bones that we can get from whatever, you know, pig farmers, like, y'all just send us some bones, and we make a stock with that, and we cook our grits in that, and I would serve that to them, because for me, like, grits are a super, super humble and super cheap dish, so it's kind of like you could take this really humble, cheap thing with those really humble, cheap bones that people are trying to throw away and get rid of, and put out a bowl of something that's delicious and filling, that's really, really cheap. So for me, that'll kind of just be like, yo, you ain't gotta serve carpet meat, you know what I'm saying, on a burger to be cheap. You can actually do something with some sense and with some love, and it can still be cheap and delicious.
You're way nicer to McDonald's.
I have every walk around buffet, the best station, the carving station. That's where I go. I fill up my plate with the carving station. I have a huge grass-fed London broil or whatever it is.
Prime rib. Jeremiah, what's your bite or station?
I'd probably give him a big, thick slice of ham, Sam's ham. We worked a food show together one time, and he walked away, so I started carving. He said, give me that knife. It's too thick. He just wants people to be able to lick the knife. That's the only flavor they get.
All right, meat mentors. Is there someone who taught you a lesson that you carry with you every day? This is for all of you.
Well, I think, Sam Edwards was brought up earlier. When I first looked into getting hams cured out, I brought a ham up to Surrey, where Sam Edwards had his ham house, and I brought one down to Johnson County to Rufus Brown. And that was 10 plus, maybe 12 years ago. And over the 12 years, I've, you know, called Sam, and we've talked about hams and what, you know, his situation was. You know, he went through some pretty horrible times with the fire and then another fire. And I've gone through my own serious situations where I thought everything was about to crumble. And he's always been super open, sharing all of his contacts. Like, there's no secrets that he is trying to keep, you know, me as a possible competitor from knowing. And he told me once that America imports, you know, X million pounds of hams from Italy and Spain and France now, and that there's room for tons for all of us, all of these ham makers, old school ham makers, to really make as many hams as they can. And so there's no real need for competition. I mean, yet, you know, maybe at some point, you know, we will flood the market with delicious hams, and that won't be a bad day. But just his openness and sharing and, yeah, not turning it into a competition, because we're all kind of trying to do the same thing, get good food to people, and yeah, so sharing information.
Who's next? Who are your meat mentors, Chef Greg?
So I don't know if y'all, if everybody knows, I'm from Memphis, Tennessee, aka barbecue pork capital of the world. Fight me about it. So one of the more known restaurants in Memphis as far as barbecue is Corky's Restaurant. I met the pitmaster, like they're one of the original pitmasters there. I don't know, when I was like 23. And I was in the, he came to one of with a hot wing restaurant that I was working at this time, and I was running back and forth, dropping fries, cooking wings, cooking burgers. He said, "Son, slow down." And I said, I got you, Chef. So I kept running around. He's like, "Son, slow down." He was like, "Listen, you gotta take your time. You gotta take your time in life, and you gotta take your time when you're cooking too. Like, you really can't accomplish anything by rushing and going fast." So it was more of a life lesson, and he was talking about pork shoulders and barbecue and ribs and stuff too, but the point was just to take your time and enjoy what you're doing, because you really can't put out a good product on the farm, in the kitchen, in the office, if you're not taking your time and you're being deliberate about stuff. So that was my meat mentor message.
You're all slowing down too much. Next, Steven.
I looked up to Craig Gill. Craig Deal, who's actually here today, I always looked up to him. He's always, to me, been like the king of Southern charcuterie. So, like, I would watch him from afar in Charleston, and while I was in Asheville, I got to go down there and stage with him a few times, take a few classes with him. But just, like, the simplicity that he approaches meat and charcuterie, like, it, for me, If you're using really great pasture-raised meat, you don't need 1,000 spices. Salt, pepper, pork, and thyme. You know, those are about, to me, what you need. You know, that's why we use all these farmers here. And, you know, we use local meat, we use heritage breed meat, because we want that flavor. We don't need to manipulate it. So that's my meat mentor, man.
That's awesome. Donna?
There is a person from a customer service point of view that I think I've really took away from, that they always said, imagine that the person that you're talking to, so this would be our customers, is always wearing a sign that says, "Make me feel special." Because that person, this is their livelihood, this is their business, their success is impacted a great deal by what we do for them, providing a service. So it's always trying to make them feel special and realizing that this is their business and what they're trying to do.
Mine would probably be my uncle teaching me the value of hard work and how to push through and get it done, especially being a farmer through harvest season, planting and all that, trying to tend to the hogs and row crop and all that, push through and get it done, especially working around the weather we have nowadays. So.
Awesome. How do each of you digest your food information and news? Wait, Jeremiah, we know yours is obviously all forms of social media. Is it print media, the local farmers market, word of mouth? How do you guys take in, you know?
Ours is all knowledge. By word of mouth. We just do the best job we can so we get the best reputation there is and try and raise our pigs to the highest standard. So.
Chefs, are you all like, food news is all through Instagram? Is it still the New York Times or the Charlotte Observer?
A few ways. We both are in the Piedmont Culinary Guild. So one of the things about guilds and groups like that is that, like, when I see chefs, we have conversations. Most times it's about how hard the restaurant industry is and what else is going on in food. So one of the word of mouth is probably the biggest way. And then, you know, I'm always scrolling on Facebook or Instagram or social media, and I hate it. I hate Facebook so much. But then every time I was like, yeah, I'm gonna get off Facebook. It's like, you need to get on Facebook to promote this thing that we're doing. So I have to get back on Facebook, and then I get caught in the wormhole again. So, but more than anything, I think it's word of mouth, just kind of seeing chefs or farmers or whatever different artisans locally that we kind of meet. And I'll see in the grocery store, we'll talk about something. I'll see at the farmer's market, and we'll talk about something. Or I'll hit them up on Facebook about something else, and we'll start talking about food. So I think word of mouth is still the biggest way.
Yeah, I guess I'd go with that too. Like, I mean, I'm just constantly consuming food information. So, like, yeah, I don't go anywhere without my phone. So, social media is huge for me. But at the same time, I'm always at events, and I'm either talking to the other chefs or farmers or whoever, artisans, and or I'm on my phone. Like, what's going on? What's going on? What's going on? So, yeah, I would definitely say social media.
Donna, are the meat magazines like still a stronghold?
Kind of, but not so much. I think the most information we probably get is from our customers because they are the pulse at food at different events or at farmers markets or where they're selling through restaurants is what they are looking for or what they're needing. That's the information and feedback we usually can get from.
Well, I think the New York Times food section, I mean, obviously I have great respect for the Times, but their food section is a joke. They don't cover any issue. And when that new editor said, oh, I'm gonna really change the whole direction, we're gonna get all serious, they don't talk about the environment, they don't talk about global warming, they don't talk about commodity pricing, they don't talk about USDA, they will do a spotlight on a lady farm cheesemonger from Vermont, and then for 5 years, they'll be like, we covered the cheese movement. You know, there'll be this big event, they won't cover it. You know, so I think the food sections need to change. I also really dislike the idea of like one old white guy being the restaurant critic for the New York Times for 10 years. I mean, the hell with that guy. I don't want that guy. I would like maybe 5 people to each contribute each week a few paragraphs. And then, you know, so each week they do cover one restaurant. So that means 52 restaurants a year get covered in New York out of maybe 3 million restaurants. You know, it's a joke. Those people need to be fired, and we need to get like everybody here to run the friggin' food section.
All right, for the final part of our show, we call this the weekly grill. We've written one question specific for each of you. Donna, what are the two most important tools in your trade?
For us, it's education and customer service. So educating our producers, the people who bring animals to us, what can be done, suggestions on different ways they might want to cut an animal or process an animal, or just things that may not necessarily know about. Also connecting through education. The guy over here who's got a lot of extra hamburger that he can't get rid of, and a guy over here who is needing a lot of extra hamburger and trying to connect some of our existing customers together.
We actually meant tools.
Tools.
Like
a knife,
slicer, a knife, a cryo machine.
I love I that she gave a more tools. Philosophical answer.
I'm thinking soft tools, real tools, you know.
Good answer.
So,
all right, if you had to pick some sharp tools just for Patrick's sake.
Yeah, a knife. No,
good cryo machine is important, right?
Cryovac. Cryovac machines, I think, or roll stock machines. That's our most favorite tool because I think that kind of gives the presentation of the meat that we produce for our customers. And when they're selling it, it has that retail-ready look, not in some brown paper packaging. Nothing wrong with that, necessarily. But it looks good, the eye buys.
How about that emulsifier? I read you make hot dogs. A lot of people don't.
Yeah, well, we have an emulsifier that makes hot dogs and bologna, so that would be another. That's been another tool, yeah. All right. Sorry, I went philosophical,
no,
I guess.
There's no wrong way to answer a question on the main course.
Okay, good.
Jeremiah, what's your best argument for getting more farmers to raise animals humanely?
It's better for the animals, better for the environment, and better taste than meat. But if you ever go in, and just like with the hogs, if you ever see them in a hog house in a crate, gestation crate, and see a sow going crazy, I mean, it's just not meant to be. So.
Short and sweet. I like that answer. Greg, you are an outspoken person for minorities in the food sector, so we'd love to know, why are so many top kitchen positions filled with white males?
So I'll give my half-hearted, I think kind of funny answer. Well, it might not be funny, but the same reason every industry is ran at the top by white males. It's the status quo, and it's how America was built. But I think in the kitchen industry, it's a little different because if you look at the 30s and 40s and 50s, I'll say maybe it started to turn in the 70s when like French chefs started to come over. Black folks used to run the kitchens, ran the railroads. It was, you know, black folks were servers, black folks were chefs, black folks were farmers, and all those things kind of changed. I think when the industry gets cool, specifically when the food industry got cool and there was more financial gain in it, because we're talking about, you know, $10 hamburger days and stuff like that. I think it's easier for a lot of people to digest going to a place ran by somebody that looks like them. And the reality is most times we go to these big restaurants, you know, it's filled with white people in the dining room. So if you go to a soul food spot, you know, you got a grandma in the kitchen or a black lady in the kitchen or a black guy back there cooking recipes, and it's filled with black people. So the easy answer is I just think that the hospitality industry and the food industry as a whole has a kind of elitist tone a lot of times when you're talking about the higher end best places and when you're talking about the cheaper $5 meal, $10 meal places ran by any minorities, Asian restaurants, Vietnamese restaurants, that food is looked like it's cheap. So it's okay for minorities to run those kitchens and be leaders in those kitchens because it's cheap. So I think it's kind of a, I think once you get to a certain level of food, it's more acceptable for white chefs to be running those kitchens because it's finer food, it's higher end food, and it's kind of, I think what the status quo in America is that, you know, white people, white folks in general, specifically white males, are gonna be running those things.
All right. I left me kind of speechless. That was a good answer.
What do you do to help? I mean, how do you be an outspoken person for minorities? I mean, are you trying to connect owners to chefs or encourage
people?
I'll say
it from a few different perspectives, like, right? So an interesting anecdote, I don't know, my friend Chase Reynolds isn't in here, but Chase Reynolds with Two Pigs Farms is in Cleveland County. He was like, bro, you should come to the farm. Like, Chase is super cool. We had those conversations about race and just different things. He was like, bro, you should come to the farm. You should come to the farm. So me and my boy Mike Bowling, also a black chef, we riding out, driving to Cleveland County. We were like, yo, man, we about to hang out with the ducks, man, see the chickens or whatever. We see a small Confederate flag on the side. We all say, huh. And we just keep driving, we driving. We see like a bigger Confederate flag on the other side. We say like, huh. And we driving. You know, we can make a left, make a right. We see the absolute biggest Confederate flag I've ever seen in my life on the top of a house. We say, shit. We really in the country now, huh? And the reality is, you know, most folks, you know, like white chefs, that's not even a... They're not really thinking about that Confederate flag and associating it with what I'm associating it with because they don't share the history that I share it with. So for me, I think what I try to do on one side is kind of have the conversations with the farmers, with the folks who might not necessarily be in certain neighborhoods in Charlotte and say, hey, man, what do y'all think about this? How y'all feel about this? This is what we're thinking about, and this is what we're going. This is what's going on with me specifically as a black chef. Like, I can't speak for every black chef. And then when I'm going to talk to black chefs, I'm saying, yo, I know when you drive out to the country, the context in which you see this place is riddled with pain. But if you go out here and meet some of these folks and have those conversations, you may find out that's one idiot, right, that has that Confederate flag, or 12, or 100, whatever. But it's not every single person that's in the country who feels that way. It's not every single person who's in the food industry who feels that way. So for me, it's more about having people sit at the table as equals, like Stephen was saying earlier. We did a community feast. We had 200 people in the dinner. We had tickets that sold for 120, tickets that sold for 80, tickets that sold for 20, and we gave away 60 tickets to people in those communities in Charlotte. And not because we felt like it was a handout, it's just because I feel like it's important for people of different whatever, different nationalities, different races, different mindsets, different views on religion, to sit down at the table and have a conversation and just share something that we can mostly agree on, like food. Everybody in here loves to eat. If you're a vegan, you still love to eat. It just be grains and vegetables. And if you hate grains and vegetables, you still love to eat. It's just pork of all kinds. So I feel it's very important from my perspective to let people know that, like, yo, I'm a chef. I'm also black. I can cook my ass off. And I'm also cool with hanging out with farmers. I also listen to rap music. I also listen to classical music. So not only just by talking about minorities and just having conversations from my perspective, it's just more about knowing that people aren't a one spot, one room type of anything. People are all different. People all think different. People all feel different. So if we could sit at the table more and have more conversations like we're having with this panel, like we do on Facebook, in a space that's not who we're voting for president and not what's going on with the police officer, right? We'll never agree on those things, but let's start at a place we can agree on food and see how much we can build from there.
Stephen, we read you always say, all ships rise. Tell us what you mean by that.
That's as far as we're talking today, you know, we're all here because we're part of the local food movement, you know, and a lot of times people get caught up with being competitors, but we're not competitors. Chefs aren't competitors with other chefs. We need to be compatriots. We need to all help each other rise. And certain people, they're like, oh, the farm-to-table movement, oh, it's done, they made it. No, it's not done at all. We've only, like, touched the tip of the iceberg, and we still need to keep, you know, helping each other rise up and informing people, educating people, and making sure that we're bringing this to the forefront, not just to food people. And like we were talking about hospitality earlier, you want to... The reason that I make the kind of food that I make as a chef is because I want it to be approachable so that I can take this heritage breed hog or this, you know, farmer-grown food and give it to somebody in a fashion that they understand, and that's like their opening door. You know, I read about an article with Alice Waters getting mad at this lady that was working for her doing the school lunch program in Berkeley, you know, and she's like, why are we feeding them meatloaf? We're feeding them meatloaf because it was taken, it's farm-raised beef ground, and it's something they recognize, and that's that first footstep. And just like Greg was talking about, inviting people from other communities and sitting at the table together, that's how all ships rise. You know, we all can sit together and break bread and commune.
Donna's answer is also coming back around to the education and then the hospitality, so... Awesome. Sam, what would you like to tell all the entrepreneurs thinking about launching into a rarefied specialty food business?
You sure I can't just talk about sharp tools? Maybe a little. I would say extend trust. You know, it's really important that you find people who you feel like you can trust and extend it. You know, be vulnerable. We are dependent on who we work with, and it's uncomfortable sometimes. But by always, you know, giving your partners the benefit of the doubt, trusting that they've got your back. I mean, occasionally they might not have your back, and it's a hard lesson to learn. But never give up on trusting the people that you work with, I would say.
Awesome. So we can't thank you guys enough for joining us today. This has been a really unique, special experience for me and for Patrick and for Katie. It's always really fun to go on the road and to do something live and to have a takeaway. We do hope you'll all come back and actually be in the studio with us in Brooklyn. We'd love to buy you a pizza and have you with headphones on, Jeremiah, with nobody watching you, in a little radio booth, as
you,
promised.
You guys all have great faces for the radio.
So this is the Main Course OG. Find us and all 35 shows at heritageradionetwork.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And we hope you will follow us on social media at the Main Course OG and heritage_radio and consider becoming a member. So please visit heritageradionetwork.org and ask us any questions. Thank you to our panel.
Thank you.
The Main Course OG is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.